some of you may or may not have watched the Super Bowl, but quite a few people have come to me since then and said, did you see the commercial that included the four loves? And yes, I did. My husband and I were watching the game. It doesn't go into the Christian elements that C.S. Lewis does, but I thought I'd take a minute and show it to you. It's a New York Life Insurance. I don't mean to be promoting that, but...
The ancient Greeks had four words for love. The first is philia. Philia is affection that grows from friendship. Next, there's storge, the kind you have for a grandparent or a brother.
Let's go.
Third, there's eros, the uncontrollable urge to say, I love you. The fourth kind of love is different. It's the most admirable. It's called agape. Love has an action.
This is good.
It takes courage, sacrifice, strength.
Okay.
For 175 years, we've been helping people act on their love so they can look back or look ahead and say, we got it right. We did good.
Just something interesting. Some other people are thinking about it. Yeah, not that one. All right. All right. So on your outline, you'll see I just did a quick little recap again of the last two weeks, focusing A and B on the two main themes that Lewis continues to bring up. One is the highest does not stand without the lowest, and the other being that love ceases to be a demon only when he ceases to be a god, but love begins to be a demon the moment he begins to be a god. So one of the quotes that I've just brought up, I think probably two or three times in both our previous sessions, was the very first thing on the outline, and I'll read it to you. It says, all natural affections can become rivals to spiritual love, but they can also be preparatory imitations of it, training, so to speak, of the spiritual muscles, which grace may later put to a higher service. And so through storge and through philia and through eros, we're learning through our relationship with others. Every piece of it is in some way leading us towards agape, which is the love we receive from Christ and which we're building to so that we can give that love back to Christ and to each other. So through these other forms of love, we can get to that divine love as opposed to the natural affections. So the way we do that within storge is, he put it as, you start to learn how to love the unlovable. So instead of growing increasingly irritated by things, you actually start to grow affection towards those people because it's something about them that, oh, that's just them, I appreciate them, they're part of my life. Then with philia, we can begin to understand people on their individual level, not as a husband, not as a father, not as a brother, but as that person, as an individual, just like Christ loves us as individuals. Then with love ceases to be a demon only when he ceases to be a god, and love begins to be a demon the moment he begins to be a god. We looked a little bit at Mere Christianity and a passage from Mere Christianity that talks about how God is love, but how that's often misinterpreted to love is God, and when we put love before God, it can become a demon, and this, it gets twisted and is misused in our lives. And through storge, when it ceases to be a demon and is in its purest form, we see that affection wishes the best for the other, and whether that love is coming from you no longer matters. You want what's best for the other. So this is like parents, their children leaving their home and entering out into the world, and the parents just gracefully stepping back, and that person maybe entering other relationships of more significance or equal significance. With philia, we've talked a little bit about likeness to God and how we're created in his image, but just because we're like him doesn't bring us closer to him. And that's what we want in our relationships. We want to be near with God, and he wants us to be near him. And through philia, we have this nearness by resemblance of what he's saying with a group of friends who are close together. It's kind of like an imitation of what heaven will be like and the heavenly hosts gathering together to worship God. And he says, friendship is the instrument by which God reveals to each the beauties of all others. By friendship, God opens our eyes to them. They are like all beauties derived from him and then in a good friendship increased by him through the friendship itself so that it is his instrument for creating as well as for revealing. So we can use the relationships in our lives to grow closer to God. But the reverse of that is putting love before God and how it can become a demon. In storge, that can be the lack of ability to let your loved ones go. It can breed jealousy. It can breed control. It can breed discourtesy. In friendship, it can breed what he refers to as corporate pride. So you're really excited to be part of this awesome group of people, and you're then really proud to be a part of this awesome group of people, and you can have a perception of others as being not quite as great as you are. And in the best sense, you're just kind of rude. And in the worst sense, it can lead to some devastating consequences of violence and corruption. So all of these loves that we've talked about so far have this dual ability if they're not centered in Christ. And today we're going to be looking at Eros and what that means for us, and keeping in mind that Christ should be at the center of that relationship as well. The last bit that I wanted to go over as review are the three elements in love. So we've got the four loves, but C.S. Lewis also introduces three elements: need love, gift love, appreciative love. And so for just a focus on God, need love, we obviously need God's love. We need him in every aspect of our lives. And so we cry out to him in our poverty and in our need. In gift love, we long to serve God. And even some of us have been in positions in which we've had to suffer for God. Then there's appreciative love, which would just say, we give thanks to thee. You are glorious. Thank you, God. In Eros today, we can see those three elements as well. So need love says of a woman, I cannot live without her. Gift love longs to give her happiness, comfort, protection, and he says, if possible, wealth. And appreciative love gazes and holds its breath and is silent, rejoices that such a wonder should exist even if not for him, will not be wholly dejected by losing her, and would rather have it so than never to have seen her at all. So that's the way that the three elements might manifest themselves within Eros. And these three elements color all our relationships. They mix. Sometimes the need-love portion might seem more significant than the gift-love portion or the appreciative-love portion. So they ebb and flow in our relationships. All right, I'm going to get started with a little bit of vocabulary for what he's going to be talking about, because we're going to see some clips in his video as well. And the first thing that I want to make sure I distinguish for you is the difference between what he's calling Eros and what he's calling Venus. Venus specifically is the characteristic of sexual desire, which is only a small element of Eros as a whole. And he calls it the carnal ingredient within Eros. And it can have a disproportionate weight in some people's mind as to what should characterize the love between the sexes. He uses Venus because he wrote this shortly after he wrote Studies in Medieval and Renaissance Literature. So in his mind, he just spent a good deal of time reading extensively about the use of Cupid as the word for love, or the metaphor or allusion for love, and as well as Venus. And so Cupid was being used in Renaissance and medieval literature to represent love at the human, sentimental, refined, not necessarily innocent, but Venus was almost exclusively used for sexual desire. And he continues with that word within his description of Eros and what part it plays. Venus, or sexual desire, can be a part of Eros. It can exist within Eros, and often does, but it can also exist completely separate from Eros and not incorporate any of the other characteristics of Eros with it. He will go into it in a minute, but he talks about the distinction between Venus and how Venus wants the it that is the sexual pleasure and how it doesn't really care about the other person so much. It's more interested in the gratification of a need or a pleasure. Whereas within Eros, Eros will actually change sexual desire and change Venus as it changes every aspect of our lives. And with that, I'll pull this back up and let him tell you what he thinks. All right.
I want to turn to the very difficult and even dangerous theme, the kind of love I call Eros, by which I don't mean sexual experience in general, but that special variety of it we call being in love. That the state of being in love is a specifically human, though not universally human, variation of sexual experience, I don't propose to dispute. We must notice at once, however, that this statement is part of our reconstructed history of the universe, not necessarily a description of what all people feel to be happening when they fall in love. It may be what some feel. A man may, for all I know, sometimes first feel sexual desire for a woman and then afterwards go on to fall in love with her. I suspect this is rather rare. It's what schoolboys imagine that falling in love will be like. Often, I believe more often, what goes on in consciousness is the reverse. What comes first is a delighted preoccupation with the beloved in her totality. It hasn't, so to speak, leisure to think of sex. She's primarily a person. Even the fact that she's a woman may seem for a while almost irrelevant. It's far more important that she's herself. If you asked the lover what he wanted, and if he knew himself well enough to speak the exact truth, I think he'd reply, "I want to go on thinking about her." He's a contemplative. And when, at a later stage, the explicitly sexual element awakes, he won't feel, unless scientific theories are influencing him, that this had all along been the root of the whole matter. Thus, there's a certain opposition between our generalized historical picture and our experience. In the one, sex sprouts or flowers or develops into or elaborates and disguises itself as Eros. In the other, Eros takes over and reorganizes sex like an invader, taking over and reorganizing the institutions of a conquered country. The nature of his reorganization is, I suppose, very generally understood. The only difficulty comes from the fact that wholly untransformed and wholly transformed sexuality don't occur in everyone's experience. There's a whole twilight of intermediate stages. In them, the subject may be deceived about his own condition. Under the influence of sentimental idealism, he may suppose himself nearer to the transformed condition than he really is. Under the influence of a doctrinaire cynicism or realism, he may make the opposite mistake. But the extremes in their, so to speak, chemical purity are not uncommon, and I'll concentrate on them for clarity's sake. Sexual desire without Eros wants it, the thing itself. And the thing, of course, to speak plainly, is a sensation located, like all sensations, within one's own body. There's no more unfortunate idiom than that which makes us say that a lustful man prowling the streets wants a woman. In a sense, that's exactly what he does not want. All he wants her as he wants a packet of cigarettes or a bottle of wine. Wants, that is, the sensations he will have in smoking or drinking. Similarly, he wants a pleasure for which a woman is the necessary piece of apparatus. How much he wants the woman herself may be gauged by his attitude to her 5 minutes after fruition. One doesn't keep the packet after one smoked the cigarettes. Now, Eros does make it possible in the strictest sense to want a woman, not, of course, any woman, but this one. The lover, in some mysterious fashion, desires the beloved rather than the pleasure she can give. No one ever sought the embraces of the woman he loved as the result of a calculation that she would be more pleasurable than any other woman. Without Eros, this desire, like every other bodily desire, is primarily a fact about ourselves. Within Eros, it's about the beloved. It becomes almost a mode of perception and certainly a mode of expression, something outside us in the real world. Eros, though the father of pleasures, has usually the air at his height of regarding pleasure as a byproduct. Hence, in his realm, the miraculous combination of great desire with great ease in abstaining. And anyway, whose pleasure? The distinction of giving and receiving is here obliterated. Now, this whole talk would go astray if I...
So, that gives you an idea of how he's defining Eros. It's a delightful preoccupation with the beloved, he says. It transforms what would have been simply a need pleasure and that carnal desire and turns it into an appreciative pleasure. Pleasure is a byproduct. Last week, we looked at how philia was this side-by-side kind of approach to some kind of task, whereas Eros, you were focused on the other person and the other person was your goal. And so it changes this need, of just having the experience to the experience being just one piece of what it is you're doing with the other person. And that's what he's getting to when he's saying he's obliterating the distinction between giving and receiving. That interaction becomes one of a gift love and an appreciation, and your fulfillment is a pleasure because it was being given to someone else. Next, he's going to go into some pieces about this being moving from just defining what he feels Eros is to now talking about it in terms of morality and good and bad. And he's talking about what should be our approach to Venus. And he's pulling from 1 Corinthians 7, where it talks about the relationship between man and woman. And he's going to talk a bit about a big misinterpretation of that passage in particular. And he says the spiritual danger of Eros arises almost entirely from the carnal element within it, that Eros is noblest and purest when Venus is reduced to the minimum. And he feels that this is not quite what Paul was trying to tell us. And he goes a little bit more into his thoughts about that and how he really feels it's not this carnal element, but it's our everyday domesticity and the things that we're approaching within this hour that seem to consume our mind and keep us from our focus on God. So I'll continue the video for a few more minutes.
I didn't at once say with every possible emphasis that these distinctions are not intended to carry any moral valuation at all. The sinfulness or innocence of the act of love does not depend in the least on the presence or absence of Eros. Right and wrong turn on things far plainer and more prosaic than fine shades of feeling. This act, like any other, is to be justified by its conformity to the great rules, on the keeping or breaking of promises, on justice or injustice, on charity or selfishness. Thousands of generations of our ancestors were married off in early youth to partners chosen by their parents with whom they were not in love. Dozens of them were good people and kept their vows. The mutual duty of paying their marriage debt, as it was called, was discharged with no other ammunition than plain animal appetite, for no other was to be had, and they did right. On the other hand, this act, done under the influence of a soaring and iridescent Eros, may yet be plain adultery, may involve breaking a wife's heart, deceiving a husband, betraying a friend, polluting hospitality, and abandoning one's children. Fine feelings don't mend the matter at all. In my distinctions between sexuality in general and Eros, I have not been evaluating, but only trying to define. I now turn to questions which do involve good and evil. With mere sexuality and all the sufferings and sins it has scrawled across human life, I'm not concerned. My subject is Eros. But this subject itself forces us to make a distinction between Eros in general and the explicitly or carnally sexual element within it. It's been widely held in the past, it's perhaps held by some unsophisticated people today, that the moral danger of Eros derives chiefly from the carnal element, and that Eros is in some sense best or noblest or purest when this is reduced to a minimum. Hence, some of the older moral theologians seem to have thought that the thing chiefly to be guarded against in marriage was a soul-destroying surrender to the senses. Notice, however, that this is not the scriptural approach. St. Paul, dissuading us from marriage, says nothing at all about that side of the matter, except to discourage prolonged abstinence from the act of love. What he fears is preoccupation, the need of constantly pleasing, that is, considering one's partner, the multiple distractions of domesticity. It's marriage itself, not the marriage bed, which will be likely to prevent us from waiting uninterruptedly on God. And surely St. Paul's right. If I may trust my own experience, it is, within marriage as without, the prudential and practical cares of this world, and even the smallest and most prosaic of those cares, which are the great distraction. My prayers have more often been hindered by petty anxieties and decisions about the conduct of the next hour or so than by any passion or appetite whatever. It seems...
Okay. So I think he's making a really excellent point here about how misinterpreted and misrepresented sexual desire can be, both within a marriage and how it's just generally misunderstood so much, and particularly Paul's passage. And he, in verse 5, meant to pull it up for us. In verse 5, he very distinctly says, "Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer, but then come together again." So he's going to dive even more into this idea of how Venus has been given by a desire to make it less a part of Eros. It's actually been given a kind of a position on a pedestal, and he calls it the solemnization of sex. And he's quite humorous about the way that he talks about it, but he's very, he encourages not to treat it so seriously and to bring a sense of levity into our lives and into our relationships. One thing he doesn't go into in the video that I want to point out is he does admit that there is some seriousness within Venus. And he pulls it out in four different categories. First, he talks about it in a theological perspective. Sex is the body's share in marriage, which by God's choice is the mystical image of the union between God and man. He talks about it at a sub-Christian level, just at a natural level, in our innate inherent makeup being a natural force of life and fertility. He talks about it on a moral level, because through sex we end up with obligations as parents and obligations as ancestors to future generations, as well as the emotional connection and seriousness between the people who participate in the act of sex. So he does talk about it in terms of it being serious within these categories, but not so serious and not so reverential that it's taking a place in our minds and in our hearts that should be reserved for God in our relationship with him. And he kind of juxtaposes in his book this idea of sex and its seriousness, and talks about it as, you know, this pleasure, but so is eating. And eating's a pleasure, just like sex is a pleasure. And eating is also very serious. And theologically, it's the vehicle for the Blessed Sacrament. Ethically, it's our duty to feed the hungry. Socially, I mean, I know for me, the greatest conversations I've ever had with people is over a shared meal. And then medically, nobody likes, you know, an upset stomach. So there's a seriousness to it, but it's at a very a human level. And so he's going to go into why we shouldn't over-solemnize sex next.
A preposterous and ludicrous solemnization of sex has been going on almost since my life began. Nothing is more needed on this subject at the moment than a good outbreak of belly laughter. One author tells us that Venus should recur through the married life in a solemn sacramental rhythm. A pupil tells me that a novel, which I had damned as pornography, couldn't really be pornographic because it treated the whole matter so seriously, as if a long face were some kind of disinfectant. The technicians, so to call them, have so bedeviled us with the immense psychological importance of getting this act right and the all but impossibility of doing so. One imagines some young couples now go to it with the complete works of Freud, Kraft, Ebbing, Dr. Stopes and Havelock Ellis laid out on bed tables all round them. Then there's D.H. Lawrence too and the whole Pillar of Blood school. We're threatened with something like a revival of the phallic religion. But we must not be totally serious on this subject. Indeed, we can't be totally serious without doing violence to our humanity. It's not for nothing that every language and literature in the world at every period is full of jokes about sex. Many of them may be dull or disgusting. Nearly all of them are past their first youth. They may sometimes be an occasion of sin, though not so often, I believe, as people have thought. But we must insist. They express an attitude to Venus which, in the long run, endangers the Christian life far less than one of reverential seriousness. Love ceases to be a demon only when he ceases to be a god. We must not attempt to find the absolute in the flesh. Banish play and laughter from the bed of love, and you have let in a pagan gravity.
Okay. So one of my favorite things that he says about this, and it leads into the next little piece about how can we have such a reverential idea of something when it has to do with our bodies. And he's going to get into a little bit about how he feels about the body and its role and his view on that. But he says, "For I can hardly help regarding it as one of God's jokes that a passion so soaring, so apparently transcendent as Eros, should thus be linked in incongruous symbiosis with a bodily appetite, which, like any other appetite, tactlessly reveals its connections with such mundane factors as weather, health, diet, circulation, and digestion. In Eros, at times, we seem to be flying. Venus gives us the sudden twitch that reminds us we are all really captive balloons. It is a continual demonstration of the truth that we are composite creatures, rational animals, akin on one side to the angels, on the other to tomcats." So I found that quite humorous. So the next little piece, another reason we shouldn't be giving sex this idea, or Venus this idea of it being such a reverential, solemn, ceremonial, ritualistic act that we need to be very pious about. He talks about it in terms of the body and how it's one of God's greatest jokes. So 12.
So, thirdly, we have the view which St. Francis expressed when he called his body Brother Ass. All three may be, I'm not sure, defensible, but St. Francis for my money. Ass is exquisitely right, because no one in his senses could either reverence or hate a donkey. It's a useful, sturdy, lazy, obstinate, lovable, and infuriating animal, deserving now the stick and now a carrot, at once pathetically and absurdly beautiful. So the body. There's no living with it unless one recognizes that part of its function in our lives is to play the role of buffoon. And, of course, every man, woman, and child in the world does recognize this until some theory has sophisticated them. The fact that we have bodies is the oldest and most universal of all jokes. The error consists in supposing that Eros can or should permanently abolish the joke. That isn't what happens. The conduct and bearing and the very facial expressions of all the sane and happy married couples we know make this quite clear. Lovers, like everyone else, continue to feel an element, not only of play or comedy, but even of buffoonery in the body's expression of Eros. And the body, in this relation as elsewhere, would betray and frustrate us if this ceased to be so. It would be too clumsy an instrument for rendering love's music. Unless this very clumsiness could be felt as adding its own grotesque charm. Better plant it foursquare within the drama of Eros as comic relief than pretend it isn't there. But, of course, the poetry is there as well as the unpoetry, the gravity of Venus as well as the levity. But this gravity, which Venus sometimes puts on, is the very reason for preserving also a hint of play in our attitude to her. Natural things are dangerous when they begin to seem too divine. We must understand and distinguish. This is especially true of an attitude which Venus at her gravest calls forth in most, though not all, pairs of lovers. This act may invite the man to an extraordinary, though brief, dominance as of conqueror or captor.
I'll stop that right there. So he's going to go into, in just a minute, this idea of the man's appeared dominance within the act of Venus. But I want to back up and point out in the last little bit how his two themes show up. The highest does not stand without the lowest. And the body would be, he talks about the body being this clumsy instrument to render love's music, unless its very clumsiness could be felt as adding to the total experience its own grotesque charm, a subplot of anti-mask miming with its own hearty rough and tumble what the soul enacts in a statelier fashion. And he looks back towards a lot of medieval and Renaissance literature, no surprise, when he's talking about how this has been manifested culturally. And he talks a lot about how two lovers, Tristan and Isolde, are one of his examples. You have this high level of love often presented, but then at the same time, juxtaposed with that is this low level of love. So if you're familiar with the magic flute, he uses Papagena and Papageno. And if you're familiar with Despicable Me, he uses which uses a minion and a fire hydrant for that same connection. But he's just trying to make a comparison between the highest and the lowest there. And then he also goes back to this idea of when the body's been given too much reverence, that's a natural thing. And if you're focused too much on that, and then the feelings that come with that can look divine, but that's the putting love before God and making it the demon. So this next portion he's going into, he talks about how nature, or Venus, kind of crowns man in this sense of dominance. But then Christian law also crowns him as the headship of his household and his family. So this is going to be a good portion here for a few minutes that's going to talk about both of these crowns. And he calls one a crown of paper and one a crown of thorns and the juxtaposition of those two images.
And the woman to a corresponding abjection and surrender. Hence, as in Shakespeare, the lover's pinch which hurts and is desired. How are a sane man and woman to think of this, or a Christian man and woman to permit it? The answer, as I see it, brings out the difference between friendship and eros at its extreme. In friendship, a man counts for precisely himself, no less, no more. But in the act of love, we are not merely ourselves. We are representatives also. In this kind of love, it's not an impoverishment, it's an enrichment, to be aware that great natural forces work through us. In us, too, all the masculinity and all the femininity in the universe strive to meet. The man does play Sky Father, and the woman does play Earth Mother. He does play Sun and she Earth, he Form and she Matter. But all sanity and Christendom require that we should give full weight to the word play. A woman who accepted as literally her own this extreme self-surrender would be an idolatress, offering to a man what belongs only to God. And a man would have to be a coxcomb, why, a very turkey coxcomb and a blasphemer, if he arrogated to himself as the mere person he is, the sort of sovereignty to which Venus momentarily raises him. Of course, man can't really wear the crown of the Sky Father, only a replica of it done in tinseled paper. I don't call it so in contempt. Paper crowns have their legitimate and, within the proper context, their serious uses. They are in the long run not much less absurd, if imagination mend them, than all earthly crowns. Thus considered, the act of love may, if we like, be regarded as a sort of pagan sacrament or natural mystery. But I dare not say this without once digressing to guard against any possible danger of confusing it with an incomparably higher mystery. As nature crowns man in that brief action, so the Christian law crowns him in the permanent relationship of marriage, bestowing, or shall I say imposing, a certain headship on him. But this is a very different crown. As there's a danger of taking the natural mystery too seriously, so there's danger of not taking the Christian mystery seriously enough. Writers like Milton speak of the husband's headship with a levity to make the blood run cold. They'd better reread St. Paul. The husband is the head of the wife just in so far as he is to her what Christ is to the church. He is to love her as Christ loved the church and, read on, and gave himself for her. Isn't it clear that this headship is most fully embodied in that man whose marriage is most like a crucifixion, whose wife receives most and gives least, who is most unworthy and in her own mere nature least lovable. For the church has no beauty except what her bridegroom bestows on her. He doesn't find but must make all her loveliness, and in making her his bride he has infinitely descended. The chrism of this terrifying coronation is to be found not in the joys but in the sorrows of marriage, whether these come by sickness or poverty, by the sufferings and perils of a good wife or the faults of a bad one. It is not the triumphant bridegroom who fully enacts this headship. It is some seedy, careworn elderly husband, inured to unreproachful self-denial, burdened with all duties and denied all rights, finally loving the unlovable and forgiving the unforgivable. Forgiving, not acquiescing in, a King Cophetua who, after a quarter of a century, can still hope that the beggar woman he has married will someday learn to wash behind her ears, as Christ...
So, quite a few images there, presenting to us, you know, how we should be approaching this Venus, as well as our spouse and our relationship with him or her. The next bit that I want to go into is kind of stepping away from Venus and looking more at Eros. And we've got about 7 or 8 minutes. So I'm on, well, actually, I don't know what part I'm on because my numbers are different from yours. But I'm on Eros as a whole, the grandeur and playfulness. And I'm going to talk a little bit through this. But C says love is God and some schools of thought on that area. And this is really looking at how, if we're not keeping Christ at the center of our relationships, how we can lose sight by being consumed in what appears to be the divine within our relationship. Because when our goal is another person and we're having this gift love towards them and we're receiving it from them, we can get lost in that. And it's a transcendence of self is how he refers to it. And it's a total commitment. And unfortunately, we can lose ourselves and our sight on God. And it can be a path towards unhappiness. And I know I certainly, as you know, my husband and I were starting dating and you were having all your peers entering into these different relationships. And I could just see friends that were just absolutely miserable, but they were in love. You know, we see those relationships in which being in love does not equate to happiness and joy and fulfillment, but there's this strong level of attachment and commitment and being outside of yourself, which are all a lot of very divine qualities. And so you can lose sight of the actual divine if you're being consumed within Eros. And part B is one of his more famous quotes about this. He says, better being in love with your partner, better the miserable time you're spending with the person with whom you're in love. Better this than parting. Better to be miserable with her than happy without her. Let our hearts break, provided they break together. If the voice within us does not say this, it's not the voice of Eros. And he goes into two different schools of thought that really focus on love as opposed to focusing on God. And references Plato, and how falling in love is the mutual recognition on earth of souls which have been singled out for one another in the previous and celestial existence. And the other one is from George Bernard Shaw that he calls Shavian Romanticism. And Shaw wrote about the life force and how the evolutionary appetite would be leading us to a partner so that then when we mated with each other, we would be producing this superhuman. But Lewis talks about the absurdity of that and how love does not mean you can actually have children in the first place, and it should be two genetic strains working towards this superhuman, which has nothing to do with love at all. So he finds fault in both of those views. And then he says that unless Eros is ruled by an obedience to God, he may live on mercilessly chaining together two mutual tormentors, each raw all over with the poison of hate and love, each ravenous to receive the implacably refusing and implacably refusing to give, jealous, suspicious, resentful, struggling for the upper hand, determined to be free and to allow no freedom. And then he says living on scenes, which goes back to his metaphor about how Venus being a play. So those are some of the downsides if we're treating love as a god instead of putting God first. The last little bit there in that section is talking about if we are honoring God and how this relationship, if honoring God, Eros can resemble a nearness to God. Eros, honored so far as love of God and charity to our fellows will allow, may become for us a means of approach. His total commitment is a paradigm or example built into our natures of the love we ought to exercise towards God and man. As nature, for the nature lover gives a content to the word glory, so this gives a content to the word charity, which is how he titles and refers to agape. It is as if Christ said to us through Eros, thus, just like this, with this prodigality, not counting the cost, you are to love me and the least of my brethren. So it's that transcendent out of yourself love that you feel for your partner. That's how we should be feeling towards our neighbors as well. That commitment, that desire for their best. The last two pieces focus on idolatry of Eros itself, and not necessarily the other person being what you're idolizing. And then the last piece is Eros being fickle, because when you're in love, you make promises and you believe the promises that it's forever. But as we see much outside of the church, and even sadly within the church, those promises don't always last.